Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget the oil and the sanctions for a minute and think about the people. Refugees are swarming the Libyan border. Also, what happens in Wisconsin after the governor's budget address? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 1st of March today. The worse the violence gets in Libya's cities, the more people just want to get out. Relief workers say the border crossing from Libya into Tunisia is overwhelmed. 1,000 people an hour are trying to leave. Many of the 140,000 or so who have been able to cross are migrant workers, all trying to do the same thing, get home. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton warned today that Libya is at risk of falling into civil war. Many of those fleeing say it's just too dangerous to stay. They cross over into Tunisia and Egypt, often carrying nothing more than a couple bags tossed in a wheelbarrow, say relief workers. Abir Atefa at the UN World Food Program says some foreign workers complain they were robbed on the way out.
The overwhelming majority are Egyptians. These are young male single workers in the construction business. They specifically mentioned that some nationalities, especially the Egyptians and the Tunisians, were targeted.
But tens of thousands of foreign workers are still stuck in Libya. Some had their passports taken by employers and don't have their papers. Others can't afford transportation. Hicham Hassan is in Benghazi, Libya, with the International Committee of the Red Cross.
They rely on charity, basically, from businessmen, from the local population, who's actually being very generous with them. They're giving them food, they're giving them water, they try to give them shelter as well.
Try. One relief group found 600 Vietnamese migrants sleeping outdoors in 40-degree weather. Economist Paul Sullivan at Georgetown University says migrants went to Libya because of no prospects back home.
Well, they're pretty much from everywhere. People working in the oil fields could be from as far away as the Philippines or Sri Lanka or Pakistan.
He worries about their home country's ability to absorb all these jobless workers, especially fragile Egypt. And the exodus is just beginning. Only 10% of foreign workers have gotten out. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A quick update now from the Marketplace crime blotter. Rajab Gupta is the name in the news today. Former head of McKinsey, the big consulting firm, former member of the board of directors at Goldman Sachs, current director at Procter & Gamble and American Airlines, a very, very well-connected guy. Also, the SEC said today, a really big inside trader. He leaked word of and profited from Warren Buffett's $5 billion investment in Goldman Sachs a couple of years ago. Also leaked Goldman's profits as well, the SEC says. Okay, so we are recovering from the financial crisis and banks are supposedly healthier. So why are there all these new fees just for having a checking account? Banks, as we've reported, are on the lookout for new ways to charge their customers. Customers are apparently on the lookout for new banks. J.D. Power and Associates said today that more of you are voting with your feet and leaving banks you're not happy with. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
By now, bank customers know that free is a relative term. PNC, a Pittsburgh bank, said its customers will keep free checking, but they'll lose other perks. Higher fees are a fact of life for customers as banks try to keep up with new regulations this year. Kevin Travis is an analyst with banking research firm Novantas. He says higher fees won't necessarily cause customers to abandon their banks.
If you know people at your local branch and you like them, that is a real incentive for you to stay. But I think that price is not always the number one consideration people have when they go shopping.
Rockwell Casey, an executive with J.D. Power, says his company's survey shows the reasons people shop around for banks are bad service and things like moving to another state. For most of the financial crisis, people stuck with banks they may not have liked.
Similar to employees during a downturn tend not to switch employers because the devil I know is better than the devil I don't.
This year, new regulations will cause banks to lose more than $40 billion in revenues on debit cards and overdrafts. So banks are hiking fees and using blunt instruments like reward programs to lure customers.
The industry is more stable and people are comfortable in switching and not putting up with what they put up with in the past.
But customers should be careful why they switch. Brian Riley, an analyst with Towers Group, says rewards programs and free checking don't mean you'll be happy with a bank.
Don't let the reward programs distract you. Don't let the free checking distract you, because there's going to be money that has to be made elsewhere.
In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
This is a big day in the business of high fashion. Dior fired its star designer John Galliano today after a video of him on an anti-Semitic rant in a Paris bar made the rounds. As we all know, in fashion, one day you're in, the next day you're out. But the fate of Dior's bottom line? Still up in the air. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
Oscar-winning actress Natalie Portman is all over new ads for Miss Dior fragrance.
Miss Dior Cherie by Christian Dior.
Dior's website says her boldness would have enchanted Christian Dior. But Portman's boldly refused to be associated with fired Dior designer John Galliano after he was caught drunk on tape saying, "I love Hitler." Analyst Jack Plunkett says investors feel the same as Portman. Out with Galliano, but not a peep about Dior as a whole.
This is a man who's part of the team, but he wasn't the house itself. The main thing right now is to keep the business stable, keep the customers happy.
And most of Dior's customers are happy, buying lipstick, sunglasses, and perfume. They never touch Galliano's couture designs. Plunkett says those only make up 5% of sales for Dior's parent company, LVMH. John Galliano joined Dior in the late 1990s, when lots of storied fashion labels hired young, edgy designers to remake them. Galliano's whimsy revived Dior, but Melissa Lasky with the website thehighlow.com says that's practically ancient history, especially to Dior's fastest-growing market, Asia.
Those shoppers aren't tied to Galliano. They don't remember 1997. It's very arguable that he has served his purpose and, in fact, may have already run his course a bit.
She says now the big brand drives sales, not the creative talent attached. Dior hasn't said if it will still show its collection by Galliano in Paris this Friday. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
The House voted to keep the government running another 2 weeks this afternoon. Senate's going to do the same thing tomorrow or the day after, which means we've got 2 more weeks of that government shutdown story to bring you. Not good on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's tempting to say the drama in Wisconsin is drawing to a close. Governor Scott Walker delivers his budget this evening, how he plans to deal with the multi-billion-dollar deficit the state's looking at over the next 2 years. What's more likely, though, is that once everybody sees the actual numbers, the politicking is only going to get more intense. About the budget, of course, but also about the governor's plans to weaken collective bargaining rights for state workers. A New York Times CBS News poll out today shows a majority of people are opposed to what the governor's trying to do to unions. But popular or not, it's fundamental to Walker's strategy. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Wisconsin's budget is a complicated beast, not easily understood by outsiders. So says Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, which researches state and local government.
Wisconsin doesn't do government like everyone. The largest single part of our budget, 55-60% of it, is aid to local governments and school districts.
That means big spending cuts at the state level cause big pain at the local level. In the next 2-year budget, the state faces a $3.6 billion shortfall, and schools will pay the price.
Really, school districts have only 2 options. They can either shave benefits and therefore hold compensation down, or if that's not possible, districts then have to reduce the number of staff, in other words, lay people off.
Governor Walker has proposed restricting public employees' collective bargaining rights.
Benefits would no longer be a bargainable issue.
John Peacock is with the Wisconsin Budget Project. He says the governor's ability to limit collective bargaining is key to plans to reduce spending by more than $1 billion.
That reduction reflects the fact that local governments, with collective bargaining no longer being a barrier, that they will be able to force local employees to contribute upwards of $1 billion more for their benefits.
But is it necessary? State workers have already agreed to reduced pension and health care contributions that amount to about an 8% cut in compensation.
People watching the tumultuous budget battle here in Wisconsin probably infer that Wisconsin has one of the worst state deficits, that we have runaway spending and debt, and that we have a bloated public sector. And in fact, none of those things is actually true.
At the same time, it could get harder for local governments to raise money. The governor has proposed caps that would limit the amount school districts can collect from property taxes. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
This just in, there's disagreement about how much the health care reform law is going to cost. Today's specific line item is what the expansion of Medicaid is going to cost states over the next decade. That expansion is part of health care reform, and like many things having to do with that law, there is much disagreement depending on which side of the political aisle you call home. At the state level, though, there is general agreement on this. States are already so deeply in debt that any increase in costs feels unaffordable, and the rules about who pays for what are just screwy. Medicaid and Medicare, for instance, conflict with each other in some very expensive ways. From KQED, Sarah Varney reports.
Health policy wonks have a term for people covered by both Medicare and Medicaid. They call them Medi-Medis, and their potential for busting state and federal budgets is enormous. While they make up just 16% of beneficiaries, they account for more than a third of all Medicare and Medicaid spending. That's in part because they're often old and can be pretty sick. But there's another reason. Medicare and Medicaid are often at odds with each other. Rules that apply to one program conflict with rules for the other, and that drives costs up even more. Marty Lynch deals with those conflicting rules just about every day. He runs Lifelong Medical Care, a group of health clinics in Berkeley, California.
There's really very little coordination between the different kinds of care that a person needs.
For instance, Medicare pays for doctor's visits, hospital stays, and prescription drugs, but it doesn't cover nursing home stays or some in-home care. Medicaid picks up those bills. But here's the real messy part. The federal government runs and pays for Medicare 100%. A doctor's bill goes straight to Washington. But Medicaid? The states pay up to half the bill, and the federal government pays the other half. So each one is always trying to stick the other with the check, says Lynch.
Medicaid state people will see, well, if we can shift that cost to Medicare, it's less that we're spending, and everybody knows that the state is in a lot of states are in real difficult financial situation. The feds, on the other hand, are happy to shift a few costs over to Medicaid because the state pays part of that.
And that tug of war can lead to some perverse incentives. For example, Medicaid doesn't pay nursing homes extra when their patients get sick. So what do many nursing homes do? They send their patients to the hospital, even if they don't really need that level of care, because Medicare will pick up the tab. And there are a lot of examples like that. But there's a sense that logic may finally prevail in Wonderland. As part of the health law, a new federal office is cataloging the many inconsistencies that irk providers and drive up costs. The list is a long one.
Actually, I'm looking at it right now. It's about 15 pages and growing, very small font, 8-point font.
Sharon Donovan helps run the federal effort to make the programs easier and cheaper to run. She says one proposal is to give states the authority and money to administer Medicare. Then they could hire managed care companies to provide both Medicare and Medicaid services. Toby Douglas oversees California's Department of Health Care Services. He thinks the idea has promise.
They would be responsible for coordinating all the care and receiving one payment that's both for Medicare and Medicaid. That would better align the incentives to provide more preventive care, keep individuals out of an institution, and ideally drive down the cost that would result in savings to both the state and the federal government.
It would also result in giving all the decision-making to the states, and that makes consumer advocates a little nervous. Karen Davenport is director of health policy for the Center for American Progress. She says for the proposal to work, you'd need strict safeguards.
So that you're not looking at states which are facing a lot of budget issues using, you know, Medicare money to replace what they would have been spending otherwise through the Medicaid program.
And says Davenport, even if everyone behaves, straightening out Medicare and Medicaid is just a first step. The private healthcare system, insurance companies, drug makers, doctors, and hospitals, is also littered with perverse incentives. And costs will continue to climb, economists say, until someone starts making sense of those contradictions, too. In San Francisco, I'm Sarah Varney for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They are really the real businessmen because they can do income from the critical situation.
Nothing more critical than getting to work on time, so meet Jakarta's car jockeys. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the Wawa trombones are not the best way to start the month, are they? The Dow Industrial slipped 1.3%, 168 points, 12,058 at the bell. The NASDAQ off 1.6%, 44 points, 2737, the number you're looking for. The S&P 500 took off 1.5%, that's 20 points. It finished at 1306. The big worry, of course, that high gas and oil prices are going to drain the life out of the recovery. Bank of America withdrew 2.5% today. Citigroup forfeited 2.3%. J.P. Morgan Chase slid 2.3% as well. Sales of cars and light trucks boomed in February, but that couldn't get auto stocks out of reverse. GM backed up 1.75% today. Ford downshifted 2.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.4%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee holds a hearing titled The Future of American Manufacturing, Maintaining America's Competitive Edge. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of current economic conditions. And the Hills came alive with The Sound of Music on March 2, 1965, when the film premiered in New York. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. 1947 is one of those numbers that baseball fans know pretty well, like 714 home runs for Babe Ruth, 2,130 consecutive games for Lou Gehrig, records remembered because they lasted so long, even though they've been passed in the decades gone by. 1947, of course, was the year that Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier for black players in the major leagues. In his new book about baseball and race called Raceball, sports historian Rob Ruck points out that that 1947 season helped Latino players increase their numbers against some long odds as well.
There were a number of fine Latino ballplayers who played Major League Baseball before the color line was broken. I think that they had a tough time, but nowhere nearly as difficult as their darker-skinned compadres had after 1947.
So here comes the touchy but essential question, I think. Did Major League Baseball writ large, the league and the owners, when they decided to integrate both with Jackie Robinson and when they decided to fully bring Latinos into the game, were they doing it because it was the right thing to do, or were they doing it for the bottom line?
The Dodgers and then the Giants were getting some talented ballplayers from Black America and the Caribbean. And then there's what the Pittsburgh Courier wrote after Jackie Robinson helped the Dodgers set attendance records in 1947. Jackie's nimble, Jackie's quick, Jackie makes the turnstiles click.
Wow.
Dodgers made a lot of money because of Robinson.
So let's come now to present day, and you point out that the number of blacks in baseball is down remarkably in the past 35 years. It's at a level below basketball and football. And in point of fact, you speak uncharitably about baseball and African-Americans in this book.
In 1975, African-American ballplayers in the majors were approximately 25% of the game. Today, that's down to about 9%. And I don't think that's particularly hurt Black America because they're not lacking opportunities in sport. I think it's hurt Major League Baseball a lot more.
With the decline of African Americans baseball has come the rise of Latinos. And you talk about this a lot at the end of the book, especially those baseball academies down in places like the Dominican Republic, where to be bald about it, you can go down there and for not very much money as a baseball organization, find some really good ballplayers.
Major League Baseball historically has benefited from being able to sign Latinos cheaply. Pedro Martinez signed for $5,000, Sammy Sosa for $3,500. Latin kids are also exempt from the annual draft, which means they begin their career as free agents.
Hmm.
And that's created an opening for men who are known as bascones, who grab these kids when they're as young as 13 years old, take them into their home, feed them, give them medical care, train them. In return, they might take 30% of the boy's signing bonus and salary.
I want to follow up for a second on this idea that there aren't as many African-American players in the major leagues now as there used to be. And this line that you have, basically where you say blacks have been driven out of baseball. What does that mean? I mean, was it economically driven or is it a different choice?
Integration quickly destroyed the Negro leagues and the infrastructure of sandlot clubs in the black community. After that, a black kid who wanted to play baseball had to come up through the minor leagues in the United States, which were mostly in the South and were pretty hostile environments. In the 1950s, universities start opening the door to black athletes to play football and basketball. They offer scholarships, which were a lot more beneficial to most kids than the chance to play professional baseball.
Rob Ruck teaches history at the University of Pittsburgh. His book about Latinos and African Americans in baseball is called Raceball. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
We've got an excerpt of Raceball on our new book blog, marketplace.org/thebigbook. Next time you find yourself banging on your steering wheel because you are so frustrated with the traffic on your commute, do me a favor and take a deep breath and imagine Jakarta, Indonesia, a city with 8 million cars, not enough roads, and even fewer buses and trains. City traffic engineers have made some of the streets downtown in Jakarta carpool only, which for some has become a business opportunity. From Jakarta, Julia Simon reports.
It's a little after 7 a.m. on a rainy Jakarta morning. And Yuni and her daughter, Nurjana, are waiting by the side of the road as the cars pass. Yuni's 28 years old, and Nurjana's 10 years old. Like all the dozens of people standing up and down this street, Yuni has her hand out, and she's looking to hitch a ride. Yuni and Nurjana are jockeys, and in Jakarta, that means that for a little more than a dollar, they'll sit with you in your car. That way you comply with the 3-in-1 rule, a policy requiring 3 people in a car during rush hour on a few major Jakarta streets. I asked sociologist Justina Sari, who uses the jockeys?
Me! I use the jockeys, executive use the jockey. They are so creative. They are really the real businessmen because they can do income from the critical situation.
Critical because a lot of Jakartans need to travel on those streets. People like software engineer Bastian Ramalan.
So how would you describe your relationship with the jockeys?
Supply and demand. I need somebody in this area so that I can pass the 3-in-1 area, and he needs money for his daily life, I guess.
It's 6 p.m. and Bastian's leaving the office. He has his own driver, but to get back home, he needs one more person, a stranger. So he picks up 15-year-old jockey, Ailu Yagin. Bastian says they rarely talk. He just pays, and the jockey goes. Some jockeys told me they use the money to buy food. Others say they buy books for their children. What will Ailu Yagin do with his money?
I will use the money for soccer camp.
But getting into a stranger's car can be dangerous. There are stories of jockeys getting raped and molested. Some have been hit by fast-moving cars. And, of course, it's illegal. Patrons can be fined, and Ailul Yagin says once the police arrested him.
For a week, 7 days, I had to wait to be bailed out of jail. My dad bailed me out for $30.
Jakarta's governor for transportation, Sutanto Suhodo, says after 20 years, the city still doesn't have a policy on jockeys.
We don't have a specific regulation or action to counter this jockey. We let those people do what they are doing as a business or whatever. So I myself think that 3-in-1 is not an effective in any way.
He says the government is looking to replace 3-in-1 with an electronic road pricing or ERP system, turning those major streets into kinds of toll roads. It seems the government is learning from the jockeys.
Whenever you use jockey, actually your money goes to somebody else. It doesn't go to the government. Yeah, but government need to do the ERP because we will get more revenue for that, and then this money can be used to improve the public transport.
Sutanto hopes Jakarta can get the ERP going in the next year, but jockey Ailul Yagin thinks all the government plans are omong kosong. empty talk. Still, if the government does get rid of 3-in-1 in the jockeys, he has a backup plan.
If I couldn't find any other work, I'd become an umbrella jockey.
Meaning he'd carry your umbrella for you, in the rain, for less than a dollar. In Jakarta, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
Produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, today I'm dating myself a little bit here, but I remember when running shoes didn't have much more than waffle treads on the soles, Nikes in particular. The true backstory is that University of Oregon track coach Bill Bowerman made the first pair of waffle-soled running shoes on his own waffle iron, a machine long thought lost to history. Well, I read on OregonLive.com today that Bowerman's daughter dug the thing out of an old box last year. It was put on display at Nike headquarters on Monday. Kind of cool. And on that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 168 points, about 1.3%. The NASDAQ dropped 44 points, 1.6%. The S&P 500 took off 20 points, about 1.5%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you ought to tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, does this sound familiar?
Let us set as our national goal that by the end of this decade, we will have developed the potential to meet our own energy needs without depending on any foreign energy sources.
Setting aside the whole Nixon part, what happened to that foreign oil dependency thing? I'm Kai Rizdahl. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.